More about the life of Thomas Hood, NW7US, in 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. From the suburban Chicago studio of the Radio Amateur Information Network, I'm Larry McGlore, KB9DIP, with the first rain report for March 2018.
I've always told people, even though there's a science of propagation, it's still fun to go dangle your feet in the water, cast your line, and see if you get something. Get on a band, even if you don't hear anything, and try a few calls. Stay there at least 10 minutes calling CQ, because somebody else may be tuning across going, huh, I wonder if the band's open today. And they'll be tuning across, and they'll hear you. If everybody's listening, you'll never know there's an opening.
The voice of Thomas Hood, NW7US, whose life story we've been excerpting from an interview Eric Guth, 4Z1UG, conducted with Thomas for QSO Today. This is our second and final excerpt from that hour-long conversation.
Back to that Sony portable radio and my first exposure to WWV and their solar and terrestrial condition bulletin every hour. When I discovered the sun and how it's a variable star, and that things are always changing, it captivated my imagination for my whole life. When I learned about the ionosphere and the magic of a signal emanating from an antenna and refracted or bounced off of the sky, for me as a kid, gave me a chance to travel the world without leaving home. And that was all through that magic of the ionosphere. So it captivated me for my entire life. I got every book that I could possibly find on the topic. And there weren't many, but I would try to absorb whatever I could. After the Connecticut, I was part of a ham radio club there. It might have been out of Hartford, but I'm not sure now. But there were people there that could explain to me what's going on with the ionosphere and propagation and how radio waves travel. And I was so in love with that, that when I first got onto the internet and the World Wide Web, I tried to search through the limited search features that were on the internet at the time. I'm an early adopter, so I was on the internet as soon as it was a thing. There were no websites that talked about this stuff. It clicked in my mind that it's time for me to give back to the amateur radio community and to the shortwave listening community the wealth of information that I've gained over the years. And how can I give that back but through a website of my own? And I put the first amateur slant shortwave listening propagation website on the internet. So I'm the first. And I can prove that because some people have challenged me on that. I'm definitively the first amateur non-government outlet for space weather and radio propagation. And that was hfradio.org. I've got a second domain, sunspotwatch.com, because that was better as a name for that segment of my website at the time. It sorely needs overhaul at the moment, but I just don't have the time to do that. I'm probably going to hire somebody to help redesign the website. But long story short, when I got a web page and I began posting forecasts and data, I began to have a following. Unbeknownst to me, the original CQ Amateur Radio Magazine's propagation contributing editor, George Jacobs, came across that website and began researching me a little bit. When he retired from being the editor of that column, Rich Moseson at CQ Magazine, that I was one of the candidates that he would suggest replace him as writer of that column. So out of the blue, I get this email from Rich, and he said, hey, do you have time for a phone call? I have a proposal for you. And I thought, okay. He introduced what CQ Magazine, I wasn't a subscriber at the time of CQ, I only had the QST. And he described the magazine, he described the column, he said that George Jacobs is retiring and suggested me as his successor. I was thrilled. I thought, wow, I've gone from giving back through a website to the potential of actually writing about this and educating amateur radio operators, the stuff that I've learned throughout my life. What a great opportunity. For the first three editions, I co-wrote with George. More and more took over the column. Rich was happy with my writing. George was happy. George retired. He did it for 50 years, if I'm not mistaken. He never missed an issue, not once. Like, what, 2001 or something like that? And I have missed a couple of editions, surgery, and I missed a couple of columns. But I just am still, to this day, thrilled that I have some opportunity to give back to the amateur radio and shortwave listening community, because they gave me, in my opinion, so much in the beginning, so much Elmering insight to amateur radio. Two different people give me rigs to inspire me to get on the air and operate. And that was love for the hobby, an act of love for the communication community to give me radios like that. You know, I was young. I didn't have the ability to afford those things. And I just feel this is my calling to give back to the community.
You mentioned your two websites, hfradio.org and sunspotwatch.com. Are there other resources available on the internet to help a ham better understand what the happenings are in the universe and how it affects band openings and closings?
After about 2005 onward, I would say there was an explosion of different online resources coming into the sphere of radio and propagation and space weather. You've got the governmental agencies, the ESA, the IPS out of Australia, of course, the NASA and the Space Weather Prediction Center. These are greatly funded now. Government agencies have a repository of official data and some science, not Radio Australia, but the IPS in Australia. They've got some educational material, of course, read every page. And there's been a lot of community efforts to enhance through the Wikipedia pages. Of course, a lot of my competitors that are out there doing their take on space weather and the science of radio propagation. There's also YouTube that's out there competing for your time. The thing that really gets under my skin is that there's a lot of misinformation out there still, perpetuated. One source, it sounds credible. They don't go and research to see if it's true. And there's a lot of myths still being perpetuated in the amateur radio community or the community at large, the public, about things space weather related. For instance, you'll hear on the nightly news or you'll hear some amateur on an 80 meter or 75 meter round table gathering in the evening. You'll hear this phrase, the sun has erupted with a solar flare that'll hit us in a couple of days and probably will make HF unusable. Okay, let's dissect that for a moment. A solar flare is an instantaneous explosion of up energy stored in the magnetic structures of the sun. When this burst of energy is released, instantaneous emission throughout the radio and light spectrum. Well, it takes approximately 8 minutes for light to go from the sun to the earth. By the time we detect that a solar flare has occurred, we have already seen 8 minutes go by in our time. We have some spacecraft that are in between the sun and the earth, so it may be that 5 minutes out or 7 minutes out, that satellite already detected it. Here's somebody in the evening on 80 meters saying a solar flare has occurred and it's going to hit us in 3 days. Well, they're not factual in that estimation. It's already occurred. That light's already hit the earth. The effect of that solar flare has already impacted the ionosphere within that 8 minute window. But what they're referring to is artifacts that are related to the solar flare, but not always to a solar flare. And that's the emission of plasma and plasma clouds that take a lot longer to get to the earth. And it could take up to 3 days for that plasma cloud to ride the solar wind and then interact with the magnetosphere and affect our local terrestrial environment. That may come up to 3 days later. Kind of gray when people talk about space weather. So I have a mission in my columns, my website, my YouTube videos, to try to explain how the science really works. And the reason that's important for a DXer to get on the radio and just start hunting, that's fun. It's like taking your fishing pole, taking your tackle, taking different kinds of bait, going down to the local watering hole, casting a line and hoping that you get a bite, and spending a few hours there dangling your feet in the water. That's fun. It's relaxing. It's great.
You're listening to a conversation QSO Today's Eric Guth, 4Z1UG, had with Thomas Hood, NW7US, a propagation writer known worldwide for his ability to break down the complexities of solar propagation. We'll conclude this conversation with Thomas in a moment. This is the Rain Report, which updates Saturdays on therainreport.com, and can be heard as part of the amateur radio block of programming on Ted Randall's QSO program Saturday evenings on 5085 kHz shortwave on WTWW Radio from Lebanon, Tennessee. We'll be right back.
You're listening to The Rain Report from www.therainreport.com.
If you have a limited window of time and you've got to feed your family and you want to go out and catch some fish, you might want to think about, how can I best utilize my time? When's the best time to go get that fish? Where's that fish actually hanging out? What bait is really, there's a bit of skill there and a bit of science. People plan for their fishing trip and then they go out, and if they're successful, they put food on the table. It's kind of the same thing in radio, the expedition, for instance. There's a lot of planning that goes in as to when they will operate on what band, which antenna, what direction. There's all that science. They'll be successful as a de-expedition and maximize the opportunity for the Xers around the world to make contact with that de-expedition. So if they understand space weather and understand what forecasting is telling them will happen, what time of year, and the statistical variances of the ionosphere, they'll be better equipped with navigating target areas and operations. That's why I'm still passionate about this. I'm trying to help people understand these things.
Well, we're at the bottom of the solar cycle. The bands are supposed to be dead for the most part. Are they dead for the most part?
We discovered during the last solar minimum, which was an extended one, such an extended long, low period, years, like 4 or 5 years of marginal, if any, sunspot activity. I mean, we went months without one single sunspot. Everybody thought going into that, yeah, the bands are going to be dead. It's not going to be possible to really enjoy HF. Start learning how to use a repeater. Start learning the VHF side of things because, man, you'll never get anything on HF. Well, that was proven wrong. First, anything below 20 meters can have good propagation with or without sunspots, especially when you get down to about 7 megahertz or below. You'll always have propagation even if there's no solar activity energizing the ionosphere. It's just the science of the chemistry in the atmosphere, and that there's going to be a strong enough ionosphere that up to 7 megahertz is going to propagate, even if the ionosphere is low energy mode or condition.
So we're talking 40 meters, 60 meters, 80 meters, 160 meters. I mean, so
exactly. Things that people consider as a nighttime band, well, those will always work because there's no sun involved in nighttime propagation. Really. I mean, there's a little bit of residual effect, but there's no direct sunlight. So whatever we experience on those bands, that's going to be always there no matter what part of the sunspot cycle we're in. But the ionosphere is this tricky thing. Even though we know sunspot activity correlates with ionospheric density and layer thickness, etc., there's also the terrestrial science of the ionosphere. And we're talking about temperature inversions, we're talking about thunderstorms, different phenomena that can stir up the ionosphere and change its dynamics. The ionosphere, for instance, is not just a flat mirror surface. It's more like a bunched up silk cloth, very textualized. So you'll have, even during sunspot minimum, we had 10-meter openings that weren't sporadic E, but were other types of modes that were enhanced by maybe aurora or other types of things, and there's propagation possible. It's still fun to go dangle your feet in the water, cast your line, and see if you get something. You got to actually get a signal out there, cast a line, and discover that maybe there's an opening. If everybody's listening, you'll never know there's an opening. Whisper mode, WSPR by Joe Taylor, is one of those modes where you can have transmissions going on a band to ferret out how the propagation's turning out on a band. There are other modes now that are very active, but Whisper was a revolutionary thing. A PSK net was another effort, especially on 10 meters, for people to understand the openings that go on. PSK net revealed a lot of what's capable on 10 meters during a solar minimum. So they were instrumental in gathering data. The sporadic E that's prevalent in the summer in North America is a fine example of how 10 meters can still be very active during a sunspot minimum, yet still give you lots of opportunity on 10 meters. 10 meters being at the very top of the radio spectrum, you have to have sunspot activity, a lot of sunspot activity for that band to be operable. But it's not the case. Sporadic E, some aurora effects, transequatorial propagation, different modes are all possible on 10 meters in those higher bands. So yeah, radio is red hot, they said back in the 70s and 80s.
I'm wondering, the reason that people are having so much success with the digital modes, well, not only because the digital modes are clever and they can recover a signal way down in the noise, but they're kind of beaconing. They're sending CQ. When for the digital modes, people would say, oh, the band's dead. They were all listening, but they weren't sending CQ. The people that are having great success with the digital modes are having that success because they're actually transmitting.
Yep. Same thing happens during a contest. People discover the bands are alive during contests, but they're not alive when there's no contest. Well, how can that be? Is it because all these signals warm the ionosphere? No. Just because they're actually on the band throwing out that signal that can be heard by somebody.
You have a link on your website to the current aurora oval. What is an aurora oval, and how and where does it affect propagation?
The Earth is an amazing planet, and we've discovered that other planets are very much like Earth, in that the Earth, kind of like a bar magnet, you've got a North Pole and you've got a South Pole. And if you remember from grade school, or perhaps junior high in America here, the science teacher that would have the iron fillings on a piece of paper, and underneath the paper or a cardboard box, they would take a bar magnet, and they would write underneath those metal filings, and lo and behold, we see magnetic lines emanating from each pole, kind of like a donut. The Earth has the same magnetic environment. Well, the solar wind, which always emanates from the sun in what's called a Parker spiral, if you've seen a sprinkler in a yard that goes around and around with like three or four arms spraying out these constant streams of water, as it's going around, those streams of water are curved. Well, the solar wind is this curved plasma and magnetic field line flow of energy out of the sun. And that interacts with the Earth's magnetic field. When magnetic fields that ride the solar wind interact with the magnetic fields of the Earth, sometimes there's a connection. Like, think of the two-bar magnets, where you have north, and when you go as both, so that one north is pointing to the south of the other, they connect. If you go north-north, they repel. Like charges repel, they say. So the Earth and the sun kind of have this interaction through the solar wind of these magnetic interplays. If the solar wind is oriented in such a way that it connects with the Earth's magnetic field, it's like opening a window. The space plasma coming out of the sun, solar wind, goes through that connection into the Earth's magnetic field, continues to ride the Earth's magnetic field, which, as you know, comes down at the poles. So all this plasma is raining down these magnetic lines and coming closer and closer to the Earth. Well, the aurora is a reaction or an interplay between the molecules and the plasma. The plasma comes in, bombards these molecules, and forces electrons out of orbit, emitting light. So the aurora is this beautiful display of how our atmosphere interplays with solar plasma. A shield, it protects us. This magnetic field actually is a force field that protects us. The ionosphere, formed by the chemistry and magnetic interplay of those molecules and electrons in our atmosphere, form this shield that protects us both from extreme ultraviolet as well as that plasma. And the aurora is like a rainbow in a different way, a testimony of this protection that we have around us. Beautiful. Not only is it visually beautiful, but the concept that we can live on this planet so close to the sun, protected by this force field around us, that's a beautiful display of our existence. Something to celebrate.
And that concludes one of the more interesting interviews we've excerpted in some time. We heard two excerpts from an hour-long conversation between Eric Guth, 4Z1UG, and Thomas Hood, NW7US, excerpted with permission. You can hear the entire unedited interview of Thomas on QSOtoday.com. The Rain Report is copyright 1990, 2018 Rain, all rights reserved. I'm Larry McGlore, KB9DIP, bidding you a very 73 from everyone connected with the Radio Amateur Information Network at www.therainreport.com. And heard Saturdays at 9 p.m. on WTWW Radio from Lebanon, Tennessee, on the shortwave frequency of 5085 kHz. Keep on hamming.